Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University School of Law titled The Promises of Constitutional Pluralism. Our speaker is Yale Law School visiting professor Miguel Maduro. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University School of Law professor Daniela Caruso.
It's an honor, pleasure, to introduce Professor Maduro to you all. In a way, he doesn't need an introduction. He's too famous for that. But I will say one thing that you don't know. I met him in 1996 in Florence. He was very young, and he looked even younger. But he was already a star. He was a doctoral student at the European University Institute writing a thesis on free trade, free movement of goods within the European community at the time. And he had already done the leap that I want my students to do all the time, which is to connect the free movement of goods across borders with the idea that something much bigger than that is happening, a real constitutional project with implications for democracy, polity, policies, etc. So we're going to hear about what that project has become, a reflection on constitutional pluralism. Having served on the European Court of Justice as Advocate General, the youngest Advocate General ever known on the European Court of Justice, Professor Maduro knows a lot about these cases and many others. I leave the floor to him. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the invitation to be back at BU. I think it's the second time I come here. So, and thank you in particular to Daniela for this invitation, for this presentation. So what I'm going to talk to you is about the promise of constitutional pluralism and what this promise means, particularly in the context of the European Union. I'm going to try to define what constitutional pluralism means in the context of the European Union and what I call three claims that constitutional pluralism can make. And in this way, I will also differentiate my project on constitutional pluralism from the usual uses of the label of constitutional pluralism in the European Union that I will mostly relate with the first and second claims, in particular the first claim that I will put forward for constitutional pluralism. So the starting point for this project that I'm undertaking, and in fact the paper I'm giving today, is the beginning, or let's say part of a broader project on the nature of European constitutionalism and what I hope will become soon rather than later a book on the nature of European constitutionalism. The starting point of this project for me is an understanding that I've had for many years now that we use the language of constitutionalism in when we talk about European Union law and as scholars of European Union law without a constitutional theory for the European Union. That is, we agree on characterizing the European Union legal order in its basic features as a constitutional order, but we do it without having developed a constitutional theory for the European Union. Now, and by this I mean a theory that articulates what is the nature of the political community that supports this legal order and the nature of the power that is exercised therein, but also then develops into specific theories on the nature of judicial review in the context of the European Union, theories of fundamental rights, theories of separation of powers for the European Union. All that is missing. We talk the language of constitutionalism, but we don't discuss what is the appropriate theory of constitutionalism for the European Union, and that's the project I want to undertake. Now, if there's been any discussion on constitutionalism in the European Union is mostly a discussion on whether or not the Union, the European Union legal order, deserves the label constitution. So, does Europe have a constitution? Does Europe need a constitution? Those were the discussions we had. But as I said, without really discussing what is the theory of constitutionalism embodied in that. Constitutional pluralism has been so far, perhaps the most successful attempt at theorizing the nature of European constitutionalism. But it does not yet provide a real constitutional theory for EU law. Instead, it is often constructed, perceived mostly as a theory that regulates constitutional conflicts of authority, or perhaps better, conflicts of constitutional authority between the European Union law and national constitutions. My understanding of constitutional pluralism is one that sees it not simply as the best theory to regulate conflicts of final authority between EU law and national constitutional law, but as the theory that can best embrace and regulate the nature of the European polity. The reason why constitutional pluralism is mostly conceived as a theory about conflicts of ultimate authority or constitutional authority has to do with the fact that for many, constitutional pluralism is mostly, and I'm talking the literature, the scholarship on constitutional pluralism, is mostly a product or a reaction, a response to the Maastricht judgment of the German Constitutional Court. Now, this was a judgment in which the German Constitutional Court both restated, but also with added strength, and if you want, added menace, that even if it had accepted the supremacy of EU law in the German domestic legal law, there, it still claimed that the ultimate authority, if there were conflicts between EU law and national constitutional law, will reside on the German constitution. And so many understood in this judgment an enhanced risk of constitutional conflicts between EU law and national constitutional law. And for some, constitutional pluralism is mostly a reaction, an attempt at theorizing, and if you want, regulating, mitigating the risks of these constitutional conflicts. But my understanding of constitutional pluralism precedes the Maastricht judgment of the German Constitutional Court and other national constitutional court judgments. For example, there is a seminal work by Neil McCormick from before the German judgment in Maastricht judgment, in the Maastricht decision, that can be seen as, in fact, being the seed of constitutional pluralism in the European Union, because it puts forward an understanding of sovereignty in Europe that renders compatible two narratives of sovereignty, one on the part of EU law and the other on the part of national legal orders, state legal orders, even if they would maintain the ultimate authority within the internal perspective of each legal order, they will nevertheless lead to the same final outcome. And so in this conception of power that and sovereignty that Neil McCormick puts forward in that article is much of what then was developed and used by constitutional pluralists. My own initial interest was much less determined by the risks of constitutional conflicts than into an inquiry on the nature of power and the European Constitution itself. So, for example, in the book that was the product of my PhD that Daniela was talking about, I already talk about these discursive practices between national courts, in particular national higher courts and national constitutional courts and the European Court of Justice, but not so much as a way of addressing their claims of final authority, but to highlight the extent to which what EU law becomes is the product of that discursive practice. And to a large extent, it is on that line that I want to continue. So it is in light of this that I want to put forward a much more ambitious view of what constitutional pluralism is and means for the European Union than one that understands constitutional pluralism exclusively or even predominantly as a theory regulating possible conflicts of constitutional authority, possible conflicts of final authority between national constitutions, state constitutions, and the European Union law on the other hand. And this vision is embodied in three claims that I put forward. The first claim is what I would call the empirical claim of constitutional pluralism. This is related to the fact that constitutional pluralism basically identifies a phenomenon of a plurality in Europe, of a plurality of constitutional sources and claims of final authority, which create a context for potential constitutional conflicts that are not hierarchically regulated. So this is the core of constitutional pluralism, and this is what most constitutional pluralists agree with. But constitutional pluralism, from an empirical perspective, also adds a second dimension. And it's one where it maps in parallel with this identification of a plurality of constitutional sources in the European Union, some of state origin, others of EU origin, both of which claim final authority, and in parallel with this, at the same time, also maps a discursive practice between the European Court of Justice and national constitutional courts that aims at accommodating those competing claims of final authority, that aims at mitigating the risks of constitutional conflicts that result from those multiple constitutional sources and their claims of final authority. If I had to summarize the core empirical claim of constitutional pluralism, it would be the following. Constitutional pluralism is what best describes the current legal reality in Europe of competing constitutional claims of final authority among different legal orders and the judicial attempts at accommodating them. We can, in fact, present this in a slightly different way. Has a reality in EU law where the EU legal order and national legal orders remain autonomous but part of the same legal system. And I'm using the word legal system in here as it was defined by a Finnish legal theorist, Carlo Tuori, referring to the legal practices where the legal order is produced and reproduced. What do I mean by this? I mean that each legal order preserves their own internal perspective, including the claim of final authority on the organization and the placement in the hierarchy of the legal order of the different legal sources and rules that are applicable in their jurisdiction. And so, therefore, they remain autonomous, legal order, national legal order, but at the same time, as part of the same legal system, to the extent that the actors practicing law in this European legal system have a commitment to both legal orders and to accommodate their competing claims and integrate them into a coherent construction of that legal system. This empirical thesis assumes that both the European Court of Justice and the national constitutional courts are therefore aware of this context of competing constitutional claims and act accordingly by accommodating their respective claims so as to minimize the risks of constitutional conflicts. A perfect example of that is the fundamental rights jurisprudence developed by both national constitutional courts and the European Court of Justice where risks of conflict might have occurred. And it has to do with, Daniela mentioned before, the famous Zollange decision of the German Constitutional Court. That is, what the German Constitutional Court did in Zollange, it's similar to what the Italian Constitutional Court, albeit in a slightly different way, did in other judgments where it developed a theory of counter-limits and other national high courts and constitutional courts. And what do? They claim that the final authority, including on deciding the extent of the normative authority that EU law has in their legal order, is held by the national constitution. And so that ultimately EU law has to be compatible with national constitutional rules. But at the same time, they defer on the judgment of the compatibility of EU acts with the national constitution. So they kind of suspend their jurisdiction over EU law on the assumption that EU law is in fact compatible with the national constitution. And this assumption of systemic compatibility between national constitution on the one hand and EU law on the other hand allows national constitutional courts to still claim that the ultimate authority belongs to the national constitution, while in fact accepting the full supremacy of EU law in their domestic sphere. And this is, on the other hand, compensated by the European Court of Justice, saying that, claiming on its from the internal point of view of the EU legal order, that this legal order is supreme even over national constitutional law, but then at the same time saying that what EU constitutional law is corresponds to the common constitutional traditions of the member states, and therefore constructing fundamental rights in the European Union in light of the state fundamental rights. So there is this discursive practice between courts that allows them to maintain the internal perspective of their legal order, their ultimate claims of authority, but on the other hand, to prevent their conflicts, that constitutional conflicts actually occur. Now, the current reality is therefore one where the EU and the national legal orders can be constructed as autonomous, but at the same time institutionally bound by the adherence of their respective actors to both legal orders, by the fact that the actors within the national legal orders and the EU legal orders both have a commitment to a European legal system that is a product of the interaction between those different legal orders. And the commitment that is a normative commitment to the construction of that legal system that requires them, therefore, to accommodate those claims and to construct that system in an integrated and coherent manner. Therefore, the question of final authority between national constitutional law and EU law remains open in the practice of national constitutional courts and the European Court of Justice, in the way they construct the narratives of each of their legal system and the relation, each of their legal order and the relation with the other legal order. The question of where final authority ultimately lies remains open. And the examples of a discursive practice between those courts abound. I've just gave you the example with respect to fundamental rights. Now, some say that, in fact, we don't detect in the way national constitutional courts talk about EU law or the European Court of Justice talk about national constitutional law, that we don't detect references to pluralism, an acknowledgement of this pluralism, and an acknowledgement of the openness of the question of final authority. But constitutional pluralism does not require and should not be confused with courts talking the language of pluralism. In fact, constitutional pluralism probably expects courts to continue to narrate the law according to the internal viewpoint of their legal order. What constitutional pluralism requires at the same time, and this is the test of constitutional pluralism in empirical terms, is that that legal order is altered by the accommodation of the claim of the other legal order. So even if the internal perspective is maintained, the way that then the legal order is constructed by each of those actors is such that in fact is internalizing the consequences of pluralism. So from the point of view of national constitutional courts, the narrator holding ultimate authority is still the national constitution, but the script that changes. So judicial actors keep the internal perspective of their legal order, but that internal perspective is in turn informed by constitutional pluralism, shaped by constitutional pluralism. While this empirical thesis of constitutional pluralism states that the question of final authority empirically remains open, that is, that both the European Court of Justice and national constitutional courts narrate the law, maintaining the ultimate claim of supremacy on the part of national constitutions only or EU law, on the other hand. The first normative claim of constitutional pluralism, and not all constitutional pluralists argue that, but many do, still. The first normative claim is that not only the question of final authority remains open, but it ought to remain open. In other words, heterarchy is superior to hierarchy as a normative ideal in Europe in these circumstances of competing claims of final authority. Now, this normative thesis, that is, that the question of final authority ought not to be solved in the European Union, ought not to be resolved in the European Union, ought not to be answered in the European Union, this thesis implies in practice another, that those competing constitutional claims are of equal legitimacy, or at least, even if they are not of equal legitimacy, the nature of their legitimacy is such that it cannot be balanced in general terms. That is, that you cannot construct a general claim of higher legitimacy on the part of one or the other. Now, here, implicit in this, is therefore a recognition that the European Union legal order does have a legitimate constitutional claim to make. A claim of constitutional authority that it can make. And many criticize this. Now, the usual answer that is given by those that defend that the European Union constitutionalism and the constitutional claim by the European Union is one that in fact is not convincing for me, because it's one that is often that I consider to be a circular. The usual people such as Bogdandy or Ingolf Pernes, for example, in multilevel constitutionalism in German, this is the usual way that the constitutional claim of the European Union is defended. That is to say, well, the European Union is a form of power, has acquired power, and because it has acquired power, it should be subject to the same constraints and limits on power that we have in national constitutions. But in fact, this will be a form of circular reasoning, because what we will be doing is that we will be requiring the power that is claimed by the Union to be subject to constitutional control, and then use this to justify the power that the Union is claiming. Instead, a genuine constitutional claim on the to be made by the European Union must depend on a deeper justification and legitimacy, one that must be derived from the constitutional added value that European Union constitutionalism may bring with respect to national constitutionalism. There is an important difference between recognizing that the European Union needs constitutional constraints and constitutional instruments to limit and govern its power, and arguing that the European Union has a constitutional claim of authority that can be opposed to that of national constitutions. The second claim requires, as I said, presentation of what is the constitutional added value that the Union can bring with respect to national constitutionalism. I have articulated this in the past in some of my work, and I will very briefly identify three of these forms of constitutional added value that European constitutionalism brings with respect to national constitutionalism and democracies. First, European constitutionalism promotes inclusiveness in national democracies by requiring national political processes in a variety of domains to take into account out-of-state interests that are affected by national political decisions that do not normally take into account those interests. So there is an increased asymmetry between the communities of those that decide at the national level on certain aspects, on certain policies, and the communities of those that are affected by those policies. And this democratic asymmetry is one of the aspects that the European Union can be seen, European constitutionalism can be seen as correcting. So to a certain extent, has a project of political integration European integration can be conceived as a process whereby states have mutually accepted to open their democracies to the interests of other states and the citizens of those other states. And many of the areas of EU law, starting with free movement rules, for example, can be seen as instruments of that, as instruments forcing member states to internalize in the way they regulate certain aspects of the market the interests of the operators, of the actors, of the citizens of other member states that are affected by those decisions. But there's a second instance of constitutional added value that the European constitutional bring. That is, to a certain extent, the opposite of the first. It regards the extent to which European constitutionalism allows national democracies to collectively regain control over transnational processes that evade their individual control. So there are an increased number and instances of transnational processes of power that states can no longer control by their own. And the European Union can, in many instances, be seen as an instrument through which states bring back those transnational processes of power and the democratic control. So while in the previous instance of added constitutional value that I mentioned refers to what we could call of outbounded democratic externalities, that is, states' decisions affecting out-of-state interests, the second example instance that I'm talking about refers to what we could describe as inbounded democratic externalities, that is, out-of-state decisions and processes that affect domestic interests. The example I most like to give to my students regards something that in Europe is almost more important than religion, that is soccer. There's this famous decision of the European Court of Justice that is called the Bosman judgment, the Court of Justice put in question rules of FIFA and UEFA. FIFA and UEFA are the European and the International Football Federation associations. And those are rules regarding they were constructed as restrictions to the mobility of football players, so to free movement, restriction to free movement rules. But in fact, they were, first of all, and above all, restrictions to the freedom to contract of those sports players, in particular soccer in that instance. In many of the states of the European Union, both constitutional lawyers and labor lawyers had for many years argued that those rules that require, for example, even if their contracts had ended, if they were what you call in the US free agents, they will not be able to be hired by another team without that team paying a compensation to their previous team. Many constitutional lawyers, labor lawyers, constructed that as violation of national constitutional rules on the freedom to contract or the right to work, for example. Yet, in none of those states, they had been able to set aside those rules of UEFA and FIFA. And the reason is simple. If any of you follow soccer in Europe, and you will see whenever a national judge, for example, or a national legislator has tried to put into question the rules of the national football soccer federations that incorporate, transpose the rules of UEFA and FIFA, the international bodies, whenever they try to do it, FIFA and the UEFA themselves intervene and say that the state cannot do that. And if that the state, because they are an autonomous order that is not subject to the jurisdiction of state courts, and that if, in fact, the state does that or the national judge does that, that state is excluded from the European competitions, the Champions League, the Europa League, or the national team is excluded from the European Championship or from the World Cup. And let me tell you, you will not want to be the judge in Europe responsible for your national team not going to the World Cup. So whenever this conflict happened, not only with respect to players, but in other issues, corruption, sports corruption, all this kind of instance, the national legislators, the national judges backtracked. Now, the curious thing is that when the European Court of Justice decided on this, and in fact declared incompatible and inapplicable the rules of UEFA and FIFA, they said initially they claimed that the sports It is an autonomous order that should not be subject to free movement rules. But the court said no, because it's nevertheless an economic activity too, and so you must be subject to free movement rules. And what the court decided, they complied with. Why? Because UEFA and FIFA could not say, well, if the European Court of Justice decides that our rules are contrary to the European Union rules, then we exclude Germany, England, France, Italy, Portugal, Spain, so on and so on and so on, from the European competitions or even from the World Cup. So the European Union had the bargaining power, had the authority that the state legal orders can no longer have by themselves with respect to FIFA and the UEFA. The only way to regulate FIFA and the UEFA rules and the public scrutiny and in forms of democratic accountability is by doing it through the European Union. So this is one example I always give to my students to tell them, look, the European Union is not always about eroding or limiting the sovereignty of the states. Sometimes, and this is a very good example of that, it's about reinstating the sovereignty of the states. And this can be seen precisely as one of these instances what Boetius is doing. He is correcting this form of unbounded democratic externalities. That is, that transnational processes that affect the policy judgments that the states do, and because they can no longer control this transnational process of power. The third and final added value in terms of constitutionalism that I want to mention has to do with the extent to which European constitutionalism also constitutes many times and often a form of self-imposed external constitutional discipline on national democracies. That is, there are many instances where domestic political malfunctions can be better corrected by external constraints. And some of the rules of EU law can be constructed as that, as member states subjecting themselves to a form of external discipline to correct even what is even poorly internal domestic political malfunctions. Instances where policies, for example, that when were originally adopted made perfect sense, but with time are no longer the best policies, but stay in place because they've developed a community of vested interests that is resistant to change. And EU law changes these policies, forces in many instances member states to again rationalize, justify these policies with respect to EU rules and EU principles. And by doing them, some instances, what it does is simply even to reignite deliberation at national level on those issues. And therefore, if you want to liberate again the democratic processes that have been captured by those forms of part dependence and vested interests. Now, I could give you an example. That's the way, for example, I construct the prohibition of state aids. You know that in the European Union, it's one of the areas where the European Union actually limits more the powers of the states than in the US. In the US, that has been discussed because of the market participant doctrine of the Supreme Court. In principle, if a state decides to help its companies with money or tax credits, that is acceptable. In the European Union, that is a state aid, and that is in principle prohibited. But it's only prohibited if it's selectively. That is, if a state has a lower general tax imposed on all companies than all other states, that is not a state aid. It's not prohibited in Europe. So imagine that all states have a 30% tax imposed on companies, and one state has a 10% tax. That is acceptable under EU law. But if one of those states that has 30% decides to give to a particular industrial sector or economic sector, let's say to the banking sector, a tax break of 15%, they will still pay more than the 10% that all companies will pay on the other state, but that will be a state aid and will not be in principle acceptable, except if the Commission would authorize it in light of a set of criteria, that is, that the state will demonstrate that aid that is being given to those companies in the form of a tax credit, but can be a direct subvention or any other form of financial transfer from the state to the company, if the state can demonstrate that that is, for example, necessary to promote social and economic cohesion. So there's the aids that the state give that are of that selective character are subject to the supervision of the European Commission, to the approval of the European Commission. Now, often state aids is presented as an instrument of competition policy to prevent distortion of competition. But in fact, in the example I've gave you, I'm not sure if that will, if a state gives to some of its companies a tax break, but they still pay more than all the companies pay in another state, why is that a distortion of competition between the companies of those states? It's not. Now, the reason for selectivity, in my view, is that it is with respect to selective measures that there's a higher risk of malfunction on the part of the political process. Why? Because when you judge on the general taxation level, people more or less will incorporate the tax and benefits of that taxation level. But if instead you have a tax break that is given to a small subset of companies, the cost of that is very diffused through society, people will not realize, and the benefit is very concentrated, so they will have a strong incentive to push for it. So it's a clear area where there's a risk of capture. And therefore, it's a good example of why, in a case, in an instance that is mostly one of a risk of capture of the national political process, we subject that decision of the national political process to the supervision of the European Commission. So this is an example of that kind of added value that of European constitutionalism in correcting possible democratic malfunctions at the level of the state. Now, these three, there could be more, forms of constitutional added value of European constitutionalism do not provide it with the general claim of supremacy over national constitutionalism. So my argument is not that European constitutionalism is the best forum to pursue the ideals of constitutionalism, has now become that. No. In many respects, national constitutions are still the best proxy for the pursuit of the values of constitutionalism. But what this does provide European constitutionalism is with a claim, a legitimate claim, constitutional claim, that can in some time be opposed to national constitutionalism. Now, it is precisely because of this added value of European constitutionalism in some areas that the pluralist character of constitutionalism in the European Union should be welcome, so long as that pluralism does not lead to an erosion of the values of constitutionalism and, in particular, values of the rule of law, coherence, and integrity. Now, it is this that explains, in my view, the third claim that I want to make from the point of view of constitutional pluralism. And this is the claim that European constitutionalism is what brings us closer to the ideals of constitutionalism in the current circumstances of power in the European Union. That is, this, if you want, turns upside down the dominant concern of constitutional pluralism. So in this, in my understanding, constitutional pluralism is not simply a pragmatic answer, a remedy for the risk of possible conflicts arising from the constitutional claims of national constitutionalism and European constitutionalism. Constitutional pluralism is, in fact, the best representation of the ideals of constitutionalism in the current context of increased pluralism and deterioration of power. In order to understand this, we need to take into account that, in fact, pluralism is inherent in constitutionalism. Constitutionalism aims to simultaneously guarantee and regulate such pluralism. Also, in the past, I've identified in constitutionalism three paradoxes that are linked to this pluralism. The first is the paradox of the polity. The second, what I call the tension between the fear of the few and the fear of the many. And the third, the question of who decides. Now, the polity is the basic assumption of a constitution. A constitution both defines and presupposes a polity or political community. It is from this political community and its people that the democratic process then draws its legitimacy. And the basis for the polity is often referred to as a people, as the people. But what makes the people? What makes a people? And why should participation and representation be limited by the requirement of belongingness to such a people? This is the paradox of the concept of the polity in its relation with constitutionalism and democracy. In other words, if national polities are instruments of constitutionalism, they are also a limit to the ambitions and the ideals of constitutionalism. The same tension occurs when we look at the paradox of the fear of the few and the fear of the many, the two expressions coined by Neocomiser. Now, a lot of constitutional rules and constitutional instruments are precisely about setting up a complex system of countervailing forces that aim, on the one hand, to promote the democratic exercise of power, that is, assure that the few do not rule over the many, but at the same time to limit that power, assuring that the many will not abuse of their power over the few. So again, in here, there's a permanent tension in constitutionalism between these two ideals. And the third instance of this paradoxical nature of the ideals of constitutionalism is embedded in the question of who decides who decides. This is precisely the question that constitutional pluralism tries to regulate and leave open in the European Union. That is the idea, who decides on the final authority between the constitutional claims by European constitutionalism and national constitutionalism? And for many people, it is troubling that constitutional pluralists say, well, we should not decide the question, we should leave it open. But in fact, this is a question that has been present in constitutionalism for many years. It is the question that dominates the theory of separation of powers. Now, of course, that national constitutions have historically developed answers attributing final authority on the resolution of certain conflicts to courts or the political process, for example. But these answers are a product of context. They are not a product of a systemic future of constitutionalism. On the contrary, in systemic terms, the question remains open regarding, for example, the balance and ultimate authority with respect to the Constitution on the part of the judicial system and the political process. So what we have is historical accommodations, resolutions of that question, but not a systemic definition that the power is ultimately concentrated on one of those branches of power, for example, within a political community. To understand precisely where the promise, but also the challenges of constitutional pluralism lies, it is important to note this paradoxical nature of constitutionalism, and that this paradoxical nature of constitutionalism, in fact, embodies two opposing poles. One, towards pluralism, precisely, that is linked to values of freedom and diversity. The other, towards unity or hierarchy, that is linked with the ideals of equality, the rule of law, and universality. And if you think about it, those pools are always present in constitutionalism, and they are often in tension. I would argue that the success of modern constitutionalism has been found on its capacity to reconcile these opposing pools at the level of the state. If you want, these pools can also be presented as tension between the openness and closure of constitutionalism and the political community that supports it. Pluralism is ordered through democracy. And in order to fulfill the idea of self-government, requires a unified and closed political space. We can only have democracy if we have a certain degree of closure to define who participates. What is the democratic will in that space? And disclosure is then entails, in turn, an ultimate source of political authority that is thought or presumed to reside in the people. The people of the political community is both the site and source of pluralism and the unified entity upon which rests ultimate political authority and provides the closure necessary for self-government. The most powerful challenge that constitutional pluralism faces is therefore the one that departs from the association made between the values of constitutionalism and the existence of an ultimate source of political authority expressed in legal terms in the absolute primacy of the Constitution, on that closure of the Constitution. This challenge now in the literature often takes two forms. Some authors argue that the incompatibility between certain constitutional values, the ones that are linked precisely with the idea of unity, closure, I'm thinking of the coherence of the legal order, the rule of law, equality, universality, the idea that pluralism puts into question and the plurality of equally valid constitutional claims puts all this into question. For some authors, this means that the incompatibility between these constitutional values and constitutional pluralism requires us to abandon constitutional pluralism, the project of constitutional pluralism. While another set of authors argues instead that what we need is to radically depart from constitutionalism as we know it. Now, in my view, the problem we face is that in the current post-national context that we live in, it is difficult to continue to talk about unified and closed political spaces subject to an ultimate source of political authority. We can still preserve that idea of the Constitution artificially by considering that we close and insulate national polities under a self-referential notion of political authority that extends so far as the legal hierarchy and claim of the constitutional order itself claims to extend. So we can construct, and that's what many people that defend, for example, in the European Union, a return to dualism argue for, we can try to preserve that myth of a closed political space and ultimate legal authority within a particular constitution. But first, this is a poor circular reasoning. It's artificial. And second, more importantly, actually, trust in political authority will also gradually erode in this context as the purported coherence and universality of any particular legal order is increasingly challenged in practice by its interaction with other legal orders. So we can try to preserve the idea that we're protecting the coherence, the rule of law, the integrity of a particular legal order by, in legal terms, artificially insulating it from the interaction with other legal orders. But this will be confronted with the reality of power and the interdependence between this legal order and political spaces that would, in fact, in the medium-long term, will give a much deeper blow to those constitutional values in that political space. In this respect, what constitutional pluralism does is nothing more than adapt constitutionalism to the changing nature of the political authority and the political space. The challenge, in my view, is that this should be done not by abandoning the ideals of constitutionalism, as others argue, but instead by adapting our conception of constitutionalism and of the nature of political authority in the political space while protecting political integrity and the correspondent ideals of coherence and universality of the legal order. The tension between the unitary conception of the law and political authority on the one hand and the pluralist conception of the society and the political space on the other, is at the core of the constitutional project, at least in its modern liberal form. As such, constitutional pluralism and pluralists are not confronted with anything new. But what we must do is to address this tension in a new context. In other words, as I said before, this tension between unity and pluralism, closure and openness, the success of constitutionalism in its modern form was to be able to reconcile those tensions at the level of the state. And what we as constitutional pluralists need to do is to be able to find a new reconciliation of those opposing pools of constitutionalism, and to do it at the European level, and to address the needs of post-national political communities. The promise of constitutional pluralism lays precisely in the success with which we will be able to reconcile again these opposing pools of constitutionalism. Thank you very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Yale Law School visiting professor Miguel Maduro. Professor Maduro's lecture was titled The Promises of Constitutional Pluralism and was presented by the Boston University School of Law. Tonight's moderator was School of Law professor Daniela Caruso. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, WBUR.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Michael Garth, with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydonis. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.